For this March 10th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. And here are some of your Wednesday headlines. Along a party line vote, House Democrats giving final approval to President Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID plan. The legislation will, among other things, send $1,400 checks to a majority of Americans, extend unemployment insurance, and allocate billions of dollars for coronavirus testing. It is, by the way, among the largest economic packages in U.S. history. Details just ahead. And today's meeting with executives from Johnson & Johnson and Merck, the president announcing another 100 million vaccines will be made available later this year. Target is partnering with CVS to offer COVID vaccines at its 600 stores across the country. And Texas is now the largest state to lift its mask mandate under an executive order today from the governor. Businesses are now able to reopen at full capacity. There are no limits or social distancing requirements at restaurants, bars, gyms, or retail stores. And the Senate has confirmed Judge Merrick Garland as the next Attorney General and Representative Marsha Fudge as the HUD Secretary. Just some of the stories shaping Washington today ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. We begin with today's passage of that massive $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill, ending a month-long battle on Capitol Hill. Democrats are calling it the American Rescue Plan. The final House vote this afternoon, 220 to 211. We should point out one Democrat, Congressman Jared Golden of Maine, joined all present Republicans in voting against what was President Biden's first major legislative agenda since being sworn in. The bill, by the way, passing the Senate on Saturday along a party-line vote of 50 to 49. So with President Biden's signature coming later this week, it will provide that $1,400 check of stimulus to those qualifying Americans who earn less than $75,000 per year. It also will extend a $300 weekly unemployment supplement that will continue through September the 6th. Speaker Nancy Pelosi announcing the final results earlier today.
On this vote, the yeas are 220, the nays are 211. The motion is adopted. Objection, a motion. Without objection, a motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
And that's how it unfolded on the House floor. Live coverage, of course, on C-SPAN. Republicans saying that the bill is wasteful as the pandemic ends with increasing vaccination and warning that it will spur inflation. They specifically take issue with billions of dollars being allocated to local and state governments. Republican lawmakers also pointing out that funds from the last stimulus bill have yet to be spent. But Democrats say that this will ensure that the U.S. economy does not stagnate. It will also cut poverty across the country. Here is Democratic Congressman John Yarmuth of Kentucky.
The American Rescue Plan will provide the resources needed to open schools safely and make up for lost time in the classroom. It will cut the child poverty rate in half. In half. Just think about what that will mean for those children and their futures and the future of our country. This legislation has been called one of the most consequential pieces of legislation in modern history. Well, I guess that depends. If you are measuring in terms of relief for nearly every American family and hardworking individual, if your yardstick is lifting millions of children out of poverty and giving parents the help they desperately need, if your metrics are a strong and inclusive economic future, both in the short term and long term, then it's easy to agree. And the American people do. They get what we are doing. They know all too well the challenges facing our nation, and that is why the vast majority of them, Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, support the American Rescue Plan. Look, this is it. Congress's work on the bill is almost done. In just a short time, we will pass this legislation. We will send it to President Biden's desk, and he will sign it into law. We promised relief. The president promised relief, and now help is on the way.
And that from Congressman Yarmuth, a Democrat from Kentucky. According to a COVID money tracker published by the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, which we should point out is a nonpartisan organization here in Washington, lawmakers already approved about $4.1 trillion in relief measures under former President Trump. About $3 trillion has already been spent or is earmarked for future use. This latest bill means that in 1 year, the federal government has allocated an estimated $6 trillion to combat COVID-19. Now, to put that into perspective, the U.S. has spent roughly the same amount of money in the past year to confront the health and economic crisis than we have spent over the world since September 11th and all of our involvement militarily over the last 20 years. More details from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. And more from the House floor with Republican Congressman Jason Smith of Missouri.
Rewards the political class, not the working class. That should be the name of this bailout plan. When our Democrat colleagues got together to describe how to proceed on additional COVID-19 spending, they could have done a number of things. They should have followed the bipartisan precedent set over the past year and worked across the aisle. Instead, they chose a purely partisan process to jam through a radical agenda, putting the political class ahead of America's working class. They could have looked at the data coming out of the Congressional Budget Office. Had they done so, they would have seen that absent any new funding, the economy is projected to reach pre-pandemic levels of real GDP growth by the middle of this year. Further, they would have seen that without this bailout, America is already projected to see its largest GDP growth in 15 years. Instead, they ignored the data, just like they have ignored the science. And they now hope that their bailout plan gets credit for an economic recovery that CBO tells us is already underway. They could have accounted for the approximately $1 trillion in COVID-19 money Congress has already appropriated in a bipartisan approach. But that money has not been spent yet. Instead, they ignored calls to provide an accurate and thorough accounting of unspent funds. Now they're charging American taxpayers another $2 trillion.
That's from Jason Smith, Republican congressman from Missouri. We should point out there was a delay in the House vote earlier today. If you were watching C-SPAN, Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene filed a motion to adjourn. It failed by a vote of 149 to 235. 40 House Republicans did vote with the Democrats. You might remember earlier this year, House Democrats stripping Representative Greene of her committee assignments because of some previous comments she had made on social media before she was elected to the House. Meanwhile, Democrats held a mini victory rally outside the Capitol. Here's Senator Chuck Schumer of New York.
So what do we say to America? We say to America, help is on the way. Help is on the way. You will receive $1,400 checks by the end of March. Help is on the way. Vaccines will be available far more quickly to far more people in a shorter time. Help is on the way. Our schools will open safely and more quickly than we thought. Help is on the way. Half of America's children who are in poverty will not be in poverty because of this bill. Help is on the way.
That from the Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer earlier today on Capitol Hill. And after this bill now becomes law, the next major agenda item for Congress, infrastructure. On that story, Jessica Wehrman, who covers transportation issues for CQ Roll Call. Walk us through what you expect from congressional Democrats and what the price tag potentially will be.
Okay, so actually I have a little bit of insight into this because Senator Carper, who is the chairman of EPW, which is Environment and Public Works, which is jurisdiction over the highway portion of this, told reporters today his plan is a Memorial Day bill, getting this out of the committee by Memorial Day, moving it over to the Senate, and hopefully getting it to President Biden by like the end of September. That's his timeline. Peter Adafasio, who is the chairman of the Health Infrastructure, Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, he just has basically sort of said spring. So that's kind of the plan. That's the lay of, if you're marking your calendars, that's what we're looking at this point. Now, in terms of the top line number, nobody's really said so far. You'll remember that last year the House had passed a highway bill alone, just the highway part of it, highway and transit, which was, or surface transportation, which was $494 billion. I think the Senate had 287. But Biden has talked about more than just, this is not just highways. This is, you name it, broadband. It could be water. It's going to be a huge infusion of federal dollars. And then during the campaign, he talked about $2 trillion. So I'm not sure how big this will get, but I would say it's probably going to be closer to the last number, the $2 trillion, than the earlier one that I was rattling off.
And what about support for the airlines and Amtrak? Because as you point out, these industries have seen a reported 95% decrease in ridership and travel over the last 12 months.
Yeah, I mean, so the bill going forward is going to be more of a stimulus bill than a rescue package. The rescue package did a couple of things. It helped out transit. It renewed the payroll support program. Those would not be in this next package. Those are kind of taken care of for now. Now, transit, actually, let me walk that back a little bit. Transit might, there may be a transit element in something moving forward. I can envision that. This bill is actually sort of aimed at rebuilding infrastructure, making sure that the economy is recovered, getting things moving. An infusion of federal dollars in crumbling infrastructure is thought to create jobs, get people back to work, create good jobs, and also address climate issues and issues of social equity that President Biden has made very clear are parts of his agenda.
And are there so-called shovel-ready projects ready to go?
There's always shovel-ready projects. you know, some of the projects that we have talked about that have been discussed would be the Gateway Project, which is this tunnel, which involves this tunnel under the Hudson River in New York. And basically, it's an Amtrak project. It would basically allow the Northeast Corridor traffic to move through the Northeast Corridor much more smoothly. Another high-profile one that folks talk about is the Brent Spence Bridge. Now, the bridge had an accident on it late last year. It was shut down. It's been heralded as this crumbling example of infrastructure since the Obama years. So those would be two projects that probably you would see infusions of money in. But there's always projects that are ready to go.
This is the headline at rollcall.com. Congress weighing propping up a transforming transport system. Jessica Werman is joining us on the phone here in Washington. We thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
At the closing bell on Wall Street, some big gains for the Dow, closing 464 points higher. The S&P rose 23. The Nasdaq, though, was off by 5 points. Well, more details on this package. It contains $350 billion in state and local aid and another $75 billion for COVID-19 vaccination programs, testing, and other pandemic medical supplies. In addition, it offers $120 billion for K-12 schools, but according to the Congressional Budget Office, more than 90% of it will not be spent this year because the funds approved for schools last year have yet to be spent. From the White House, more details on the president's expected signature.
I can announce that the president will sign the bill at the White House on Friday afternoon. We spent a lot of time, of course, from the podium talking about the mechanics of how a bill becomes a law, and I know there's lots of interest in what comes next. So once it's passed, the bill text will be rechecked, printed, and signed by the appropriate leaders in the House and Senate. The House clerks will then deliver it to the White House for the president's signature. We expect that delivery to happen sometime tomorrow, and then the president will sign it on Friday. We, of course, are moving full speed ahead on the implementation of the bill because we know the American people need help and need it as soon as possible. The way we are also working on looking ahead to implementation. I wanted to make sure you all saw Secretary Yellen's speech before the National League of Cities yesterday, promising to get aid out to state and local governments. Obviously, this is a key component of the package and one that will help keep cops, firefighters, local officials in their jobs. And we are looking there. They are looking for ways to maximize, of course, the impact of every dollar. That's exactly what the president did when he served as the point person on the implementation of the Recovery Act in 2009, partnering with mayors, governors, and other officials to get help to them quickly and in a way that kept waste, fraud, and abuse to 0.2%. So he knows directly that The passage and signing of the bill is just the beginning, and he will he plans to appoint somebody to run point on implementation. I don't have any personnel announcements today, but that will certainly be part of our path moving forward.
And that's from White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. We should also point out the president will address the nation tomorrow evening. We, of course, will have live coverage here on C-SPAN Radio and C-SPAN Television. And President Biden directing his administration to secure an additional 100 million doses of Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine by the end of this year. Earlier today at the White House, he had met with the CEO of J&J, Alex Gorsky, and Merck's CEO, Kenneth Frazier. Here's more with President Biden.
I want to thank scientists and researchers at Johnson & Johnson for the literal heroic effort that began when COVID-19 first spread and led to the safe and effective vaccine that are now being co-produced. Today, we're seeing two health companies, competitors, each with over 130 years of experience, coming together to help write a more hopeful chapter in our battle against COVID-19. I just had an opportunity to meet with both of these CEOs and with their senior operating officers and to hear about the work they're doing together to produce vaccine substitute and accelerate what they call to take it to full finish. You know, what's clear is this is historic, nearly unprecedented collaboration. During World War II, one of the country's slogans was, "We are all in this together." We are all in this together. And the companies took that slogan to heart. For example, one automaker didn't have the capacity to build enough Jeeps. A competitor stepped in to help. Competing airline makers teamed up, and they produced parts for each other and gave the American pilots, as a consequence of that, control of the skies. Today, we're seeing the same type of collaboration when it comes to getting this virus under control. I said we had to treat this like a war. So I want to thank the two companies for showing how we can come together and defeat this virus by putting patriotism and public health first. And I mean that literally, putting patriotism and public health first.
With more in today's announcement by the president, we're joined on the phone White House reporter Sabrina Siddiqui of The Wall Street Journal. First of all, what does this mean for the overall demand and the supply of these vaccines?
Well, President Biden has focused initially on trying to accelerate the pace of vaccinations. And so today's announcement is effectively a directive that his administration secure an additional 100 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson coronavirus vaccine by the end of the year. Now, we already know that the Biden administration believes that it will have enough doses to inoculate the adult U.S. population by May, and what they are trying to do is plan ahead for the second half of the year and ensure that the supply remains steady and maintain some degree of flexibility if there is a need to continue and administer more doses.
And as you point out, your story available at WSJ.com, the Johnson & Johnson dose is only one shot, whereas Moderna and Pfizer is a two-shot process.
Yes, and I think that's part of why there's an emphasis on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine moving forward, because as you pointed out, it is a single shot and it is also cheaper to make. It does not have the same storage requirements as the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccine. So there are many health officials who kind of see the J&J vaccine as the future. Now, you know, it is important to note that these additional 100 million doses that the Biden administration is trying to secure are not expected to be delivered until the second half of the year.
What about the overall distribution of this, not only in terms of the timeline, which you just alluded to, but also making sure that these shots get in the arms of Americans?
Well, that's going to be a key question moving forward, because on the one hand, the administration is saying that it will have sufficient supply to cover the eligible U.S. population in May. But then to your point, how do you actually get shots into people's arms? And so we've seen some of these efforts to ramp up vaccinations across the country, standing up these federal vaccine sites, these mass vaccination sites, increasing the number of allotments that go out to states and pharmacies each week, and trying to create incentives at companies to also, you know, get the business community involved in vaccinating employees and trying to help get people to and from these vaccination sites. So, you know, there's a lot more that they have to say in terms of how they're going to get to a point where most Americans have actually received a vaccine, or that anyone who wants a vaccine can get one. They also have to answer how they're going to overcome vaccine hesitancy. So I think that's where the conversation is going to go moving forward. But today's announcement seems more focused on just procuring enough supply so that they not only are able to vaccinate the adult population, but they also account for if people, for example, require a booster shot later in the year with the new variants, or if the vaccine is approved for children, how do you ensure that they will have supply ahead of time rather than trying to, you know, play catch up?
The story tonight on the web and in tomorrow's Wall Street Journal. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And of course, all of this means more in-person learning in Fairfax County, Virginia. Schools gradually reopen, and we learned today that next month, the Los Angeles School District will begin resuming in-person classes. At today's White House COVID briefing, CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky again advising Americans, even those who are vaccinated, to remain cautious about travel plans during the immediate future, and she offered this update.
Let's take a look at the current state of the pandemic. CDC's most recent data indicate that the recent plateau of cases may be again starting to trend downward, with a seven-day average now of 56,000 cases per day. We also continue to see decreases in new hospital admissions for the most recent week. An average of 4,900 patients with COVID-19 were admitted per day in the most recent week. And while we have seen deaths hovering around 2,000 deaths per day in recent weeks, the latest seven-day average is now down to 1,600 deaths per day. Earlier this week, we saw the number of deaths per day drop below 1,000 for the first time since November. All of this is really good news. And while these trends are starting to head in the right direction, the number of cases, hospitalizations, and deaths still remain too high and are somber reminders that we must remain vigilant as we work to scale up our vaccination efforts across this country. We must continue to use proven prevention measures to slow the spread of COVID-19. They are getting us closer to the end of this pandemic.
That from the CDC director, nearly 1 in 10 Americans, about 32 million of us, now fully vaccinated against COVID-19. On CNN this morning, Dr. Anthony Fauci was asked about the vaccines and also what it means for those who may want to hop on a plane and travel again during spring and summer.
You know from the Biden administration that they say it will make its decisions based on science. What's the science behind not saying it's safe for people who have been vaccinated, received two doses, to travel?
You know, that's a very good question, John. And the CDC is carefully heading in that direction. You note when Dr. Walensky made the announcement a day or two ago about the fact that when you have a couple of people, two or three or more people in a family setting, both of whom are vaccinated, even if it's someone from another, a friend that doesn't have to be a member of the family, that was the first in a multi-step process that they are going to be rolling out. They're being careful, understandably. They want to get science. They want to get data. And then when you don't have the data, and you don't have the actual evidence, then you've got to make a judgment call. And I think that's what you're going to be seeing in the next weeks. You're going to see little by little more and more guidelines getting people to be more and more flexible. The first installation of this is what can vaccinated people do in the home setting? Obviously, the next one is going to be what you're asking. What about travel? What about going out? What about getting a haircut? What about doing things like that? That's all imminently going to be coming out.
And that from Dr. Anthony Fauci on CNN this morning. You're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. Here are some of your other headlines. Because of the new COVID relief plan, which provides billions to the airline industry, American Airlines has canceled employee furloughs. In a memo, CEO Doug Parker saying that the notices to 13,000 employees received last month, those furloughs are, quote, happily canceled. You can tear them up. And another part of the bill providing nearly $2 billion to modernize and upgrade cybersecurity technology. Democrats are calling it a down payment to deal with recent foreign cyber attacks here in the U.S. The Senate with a couple of confirmations today, including that for the new Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, lawmakers voting to confirm Representative Marsha Fudge to serve as the HUD Secretary, the Ohio Congresswoman first elected in 2008. Senator Sherrod Brown speaking about his colleague earlier today.
I urge my colleagues to join me in supporting a dedicated and talented public servant and a great Ohioan, my congresswoman for the last 12 years, Marcia Fudge, to be our next Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. I know the presiding officer served with her in the House of Representatives and appreciate her. I can think of no one better to lead us out of this pandemic and create strong communities for the future than Marcia Fudge. When she came before Banking and Housing Committee, Congresswoman Fudge's knowledge, her passion for service, her commitment to the people who make this country work were obvious to all of us, Republicans and Democrats alike. After a year when Black Americans endured so many painful reminders of the yawning gap between the promise of our founding ideals and our failure to make that promise real for everyone, it's meaningful that our committee's first nomination hearing featured two African American women who will take leading roles in our economic recovery, Marcia Fudge and Dr. Cecilia Rouse, who has been confirmed already to be chair of the National Economic Council at the White House. The Senate confirmed Dr. Rouse with broad bipartisan support earlier this month. This matters on so many levels. It's important for our future that little girls, including Black and brown girls, see themselves in our leaders, from the vice president to Marcia Fudge to Cecilia Rouse to so many people in this cabinet. It matters because of including the new Secretary of the Interior from presiding officer's area of the country. It matters because of the perspectives and the life experiences these two Black women bring to these jobs. Congressman Fudge will lead an agency that supports families and communities, provides housing and safety to people experiencing homelessness, and helps communities rebuild. HUD today is grappling with a housing market where millions of families find it harder and harder to afford a decent home. New data out this week confirms that home prices are soaring around the country even while millions are out of work. Imagine that. The cost of housing is up, but wages are flat. So many workers have trouble making rent every month with the kind of stress that brings, and too often having to turn to predatory loans. The dream of home ownership is increasingly out of reach for too many families in New Mexico, too many families in Ohio. None of this started with COVID-19. The affordable housing crisis is the product of decades of conscious policy decisions by Wall Street, by corporations, and too often by government. This pandemic has exposed what millions of families in this country already knew, that for far too many people, a hard day's work doesn't pay the bills.
And that from Senator Sherrod Brown on today's confirmation vote, the Senate approving Marcia Fudge as the HUD secretary. The vote was 66 to 34. And 5 years after his confirmation to serve as the U.S. Supreme Court, a confirmation that was blocked by Senate Republicans, Federal Appeals Court Judge Merrick Garland was confirmed today as the next Attorney General. The vote in the Senate was 70 to 30. He takes over as the head of the Justice Department as the investigation continues into the events of January 6th, the attack on the U.S. Capitol, which, by the way, is one of the largest inquiries in our history. DOJ will also play a key role as President Biden moves ahead with plans for criminal justice reform and some proposed regulations that could affect some of the country's largest technology companies. Among the 30 Republican senators opposing the Merrick Garland nomination, Arkansas Republican Senator Tom Cotton.
He also said he just doesn't know whether President Biden has the authority to ban certain semi-automatic rifles, some of the most popular sporting firearms today. He doesn't know if President Biden has the authority to ban them by executive order. He's also said he's just not familiar with whether the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, which would report to him if he's confirmed, I would remind everyone, would have the authority to indefinitely delay approving gun sales to Americans who have not had any flags show up in their background checks. Once again, Judge Garland demonstrated through his evasion that he would bow to the radical left to the detriment of normal, law-abiding American citizens. So I urge every senator who believes in the Second Amendment and the rule of law and who cares about stopping crime in our streets to reject Judge Merrick Garland's nomination for Attorney General. Now is not the time for weakness, evasion, and obfuscation from our nation's foremost law enforcement officer. We need strength, resolve, and certainty. Our nation needs and deserves a better nominee for Attorney General. I will oppose his nomination.
Well, that from Senator Tom Cotton, just some of the opposition. But again, the final vote was bipartisan. Merrick Garland is the next attorney general. The vote 70-30 earlier today. We carried it live on C-SPAN 2. Now to the situation along the U.S.-Mexico border. Law enforcement officials have encountered more than 100,000 immigrants at the border this past month, a number that the White House does admit has been, quote, overwhelming. Ambassador Roberta Jacobson is a special assistant to the president. She previously served as the U.S. envoy to Mexico. Adding to the problem of more immigrants, a rapid influx of unaccompanied migrant children. More from today's briefing.
President Biden, when he was vice president, visited the region many times and is clear-eyed about the challenge. He insists now, as he did then, that governments commit to being true partners in creating the conditions for growth and security. But I want to emphasize that the funds we're asking for from Congress don't go to government leaders. They go to communities, to training, to climate mitigation, to violence prevention, to anti-gang programs. In other words, they go to the people who otherwise migrate in search of hope. And they will have to have the participation of the private sectors in those countries, who for too long have evaded taxes, underpaid workers, and failed to be part of the solution to creating safe, prosperous, and democratic countries. We've already begun specific actions to both undo the previous administration's policies and to advance a new vision of immigration. We have ended the so-called migrant protection protocols, which sent people back to Mexico to wait, sometimes for years, for a chance to present their asylum claims. Working with the government of Mexico, international organizations, and NGOs, we have safely admitted over 1,400 migrants and closed the most dangerous face of the MPP, the Matamoros migrant camp. Today, we are announcing the restarting of the Central American Minors Program for children to be reunited with a parent who is legally in the United States. This program was ended abruptly by the previous administration, leaving around 3,000 children already approved for travel stranded. In phase two, we will be working to improve the CAM program to expand safe and legal avenues to the United States. I want to be clear. Neither this announcement nor any of the other measures suggest that anyone, especially children and families with young children, should make the dangerous trip to try and enter the U.S. in an irregular fashion. The border is not open. Going forward, we will continue to look for ways to provide legal avenues in the region for people needing protection while we continue to enforce our laws. This is a process. We have a great deal to do. But this administration has made significant progress, and we will continue to do so. It reflects who we are as Americans, putting our values at the center of our policy.
That from Roberta Jackson. She is a senior advisor and special assistant to the president dealing with border issues. And meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, was asked about the situation there. He testified before the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Its ranking member is Texas Congressman Mike McCaul.
I want to start with the crisis at the border. Recently, the Biden administration canceled asylum cooperation agreements and remained in Mexico. Since that time, we've seen a massive surge of migrants crossing and causing a crisis at our southern border. Why did the president rescind these agreements that were supported by our neighbors to the south?
Thank you. As a general matter, I really want to defer to my colleague, Ali Mayorkas at DHS to deal with questions on immigration. I would just say, with regard to those agreements, only one of them was actually in effect with Guatemala. You're correct that all three were rescinded. But the president is determined that we have a safe, orderly, and humane border. There's a lot of work that goes into making it such. It's going to take time to do that, and we very much look forward to working with Congress to try to achieve that, to have a rational asylum process, to have a refugee program that works once again to the best traditions of our country, and to make sure, again, that the border is safe, it is orderly, but it is also humane. But as I said, this takes time to do. In the meantime, we've also been very clear in saying to people, do not come to the United States now. Do not attempt irregular migration. You will not.
Well, that end of my time is, I'll question the Secretary of Homeland Security next week, but yeah. The messaging has been a little mixed, and I think it appears to be, we're open. And I live in a border state. I was a federal prosecutor. You know, when you send that message down there, they're going to come, and they are coming, and it has created a humanitarian crisis down there. We have so many children that we cannot even detain right now. So.
And that from today's House Foreign Affairs Committee. It's available on our website at cspan.org. Also news from the Secretary of State. Tony Blinken does travel to Asia next week. He'll also make a stop in Anchorage, Alaska, where we learned today he will meet face-to-face with his Chinese counterparts. In a newly released report, the Congressional Budget Office has a new warning on the future of Medicare, especially Part A Medicare. That, of course, the funding for hospitalization stay and any related services for senior citizens. It is facing the possibility of insolvency by 2026. Robert Moffitt is a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He wrote about this new finding today at dailysignal.com. And earlier today, I asked him what it means for the program and for taxpayers who fund it.
The Medicare program is facing an immediate fiscal challenge. The Medicare Board of Trustees, who are responsible for overseeing the program, say that the hospitalization trust fund, that is the part of the Medicare program that pays for all hospitalization and medical-related services, will be insolvent in 2026. What that means is that the Medicare program will not be able to pay for all of the promised benefits. The Medicare trustees say that in 2026, there will be a 10% reduction in payment, which means that you will have a reduction in payment for medical services, and that will effectively affect directly the beneficiaries who are dependent on those services.
And let me underscore, that's only 5 years away.
It's 5 years away, and the trustees make the point that the trust fund insolvency has never occurred before, but the congressional options are very limited, and they're not going to be pleasant. Either you're going to increase the federal payroll tax, which, as you know, Steve, is a very regressive tax. It applies to all workers. It's a federal payroll tax. They could do a surcharge on Medicare beneficiaries, charging Medicare beneficiaries more, or they could transfer general revenues out of the general treasury into the trust fund. That means, of course, that we're just simply going to increase the deficits and deficit spending, and that's going to be higher income and business taxes later on. Or what they might do is they could resort to some sort of tougher set of price controls on doctors and hospitals and other Medicare providers. I would just remind you, though, that just coming off the pandemic, doctors and hospitals in particular have suffered quite a bit, and that would be pouring gasoline on that fire. So, you know, there are no painless options that are available here.
And in your piece, which, by the way, is available tonight at dailysignal.com, you also write about a demographic imbalance when it comes to taxpayers funding Medicare. Explain what the numbers tell you.
Yeah, well, the numbers actually are not my numbers. They're the Medicare trustees. But the beneficiary enrollment has doubled over the past 35 years. Now we have around 62 million people who are on the Medicare program. But that will grow by about 50% over the next 35 years. The problem is that the number of workers who are supporting each Medicare beneficiary in taxes, that ratio of workers to beneficiaries is declining. Just to give you an example, in 2008, there were four workers to each Medicare beneficiary. In 2019, that shrunk to about three workers to each beneficiary. And in 9 years, 2030, when the baby boomers are fully retired, there will only be 2.5 workers supporting each Medicare beneficiary. So that means you're either going to have a much bigger increase in taxes, or you're going to have some kind of payment cuts to the Medicare program to maintain its solvency.
The headline, Washington Must Face the Coming Medicare Crisis, the perspective of Robert Moffitt, his work available at heritage.org. We thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much, Steve. Pleasure.
In this note, we take a deeper look at the growing federal debt, $28 trillion, and expanding rapidly on our podcast, The Weekly. It's posted every Friday and airs every Friday afternoon at 5:30 Eastern Time here on C-SPAN Radio. And a reminder, this program is also available as a podcast. Be sure to sign up so you never miss an episode. For the Wednesday edition of Washington Today, I'm Steve Scully, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.